Prayer is a good prayer.
Hello, good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me. Sometimes I've been told when I present that I speak too fast, so I think hopefully because I'm a bit tired, that will slow me down. I've been thinking and writing about embodiment for a number of years, and something that has been dawning on me is the extent to which when we say that we are our bodies, or when we talk about embodied practice and embodied knowledge, to what extent the audiovisual incarnation and reflection of embodiment is informing that idea of what the body is, and the whole several decades of thinking about embodiment and bodies and performance are in some very close relationship with the rise of audiovisual media and the way that we understand what bodies are in relation to text or ideas or life. So I thought I would respond to this idea, I am my body, with I am my audiovisual body, this idea of the audiovisual body that I've been thinking about for a while, and just to start off with this kind of amusing but actually quite sophisticated Instagram post from Strawberry Peak. There's several things we can take from this. First of all, as soon as we appear in the audiovisual world, particularly if we are read as female, although increasingly for all of us, we are policed in our appearance, and we can immediately receive emails and comments of various kinds that tell us how we ought to change our bodies in order to fit various dominant standards. Strawberry Puke has taken this comment, which she has anonymized because it absolutely doesn't matter at all who said this, and responded to it in an audiovisual way. It's a visual way. It's a visual medium, it's a photographic medium, but she's used two photographs next to each other to show a kind of choreography in which she moves from a choreography that tries to enact this standard that is demanded to a different choreography which actively works against the standard that is being demanded. And this second choreography reveals a new surface of the body, which in the first choreography is completely hidden. The neck, which totally doesn't exist in the first image, and then in the second image is brought forward. And on this new surface, she has written her response to the comment. And what I think is so exciting and sophisticated about this is the way that she is using her image, writing on her body in a very clear way, and in that way, claiming, reclaiming, taking control over, or at least rearticulating what her body is and what it means by writing on it. And it's different than if she wrote those words, fuck you, underneath the photo of her, right? She hasn't done that. She's written on her body in a very specific way that would be not so easy, although you could do it to put in Photoshop. She's written on herself and then taken a photo of that and then uploaded that. So that's kind of what I want to talk about today is, as bodies, and particularly as embodied practitioners and performers, creators of performance, how we write on and can frame our bodies, our audiovisual bodies. So let me start by going way back to some much older audiovisual bodies. This is a slide that I've been showing for maybe 10 years almost, 5 or 10 years. These are kind of historical audiovisual, well, historical visual documents. The top two are from the 30s, bottom are from the 60s and 70s. I chose them as illustrations of research initially, because all of these people are in the process of discovering or inventing areas of technique which you can now go and train in many, many cities in the world. Certainly we know about the massive rise of postural yoga, the massive spread and uptake and adaptation of Stanislavski and acting technique. Dance movement therapy is now accredited in many places, and maybe not the plastiques, but certainly the word Grotowski can be still used to talk about actor training. So all of these areas still exist, even though most of the practitioners are no longer alive. And that, for me, has always been a kind of way of thinking about what embodied research could mean. Of course, we could also think about these videos in a lot of other ways. They are really interesting historical documents. You can think about the gender, the nationality, racialization, the different kinds of politics being enacted in the various images. There's indoor and outdoor, there's differences in age, there's differences in intent in terms of physical, spiritual, psychological healing, or artistic creation. But this is not the world that we're in now, so I'm going to talk today hopefully quite practically. I mean, thinking about the context of this week, I want to arrive to some kind of concrete proposals or offerings that are quite practical, which is a little bit different from how I usually present, but I want to be not only theoretical, but kind of offer some tools. But I'm starting out with a larger historical, cultural kind of context for these ideas, where I think we, a little bit like Strawberry Puke, we are in the position of responding to a massive context of audiovisual bodies from a very specific position of embodied practice or embodied research. And how do we respond to that massive world? But what is that massive world? So let's look for a moment. That's not my field of expertise, kind of social media or even screen studies, but it's something that I've been compelled to learn more about precisely because of this question: as embodied practitioners or embodied researchers, how do we respond back to that world and that circulation of audiovisual bodies? Which brings me to these folks, who seem really nice. Like, the more I look at them, the more I kind of feel like, almost like I know them, or I would like to know who they are. There's something, you know, I think it's just because it's close-ups, and you know, you keep looking at close-ups for a while, it's like, who is this person? But I can never find out, because they're invented people who don't exist, created by a particular kind of algorithm newly in development, where you can invent audiovisual bodies out of massive quantities of data about audiovisual bodies, so these people don't exist. And that changes very much our relationship to video, fundamentally, that relationship to that kind of document, because in the previous set of videos, in the 30s and then also still in the 60s and 70s, I think, we could pretty much assume that if there was a video of something, it happened. And that's really different than how we think about text, because it's always been possible to write down that someone said something when they didn't say it. But it didn't used to be possible to have a video of someone doing something if they didn't do it. Although you could take it out of context. I mean, editing is always a kind of rhetoric. But there's a new level that we're reaching technologically, which is scary in some ways. This is mostly framed in terms of fake news, I mean, for obvious reasons. And since I'm not an expert on this, I thought I would play us a very short video, 2.5 minutes, very kind of like social media, flashy, fast video, but like an introduction to the world of deepfake, non-existent audiovisual bodies. Oops, lost the sound. Is the sound possible? It was here before. Oops. I can kind of narrate it myself. Maybe it's better anyway. I mean, you can... Right, so you can make people do things on video that they never did because you can map their face onto your face. And then you... I mean, you can, you know, depending on what kind of technology you use, it can be more or less realistic. But obviously, it's only a few years before it's not distinguishable. Maybe that's all we need of that. I mean, that's the main point, is that we're entering an era in which video increasingly obeys the same rules as text. Which is not how it's usually framed. I mean, it's usually framed like in that kind of video as a problem in relation to fake news, which it is, but it's kind of framed as like, oh no, reality is falling apart, how will we ever tell anything from anything? When in fact textual reporting has always had that quality, it just means that the framing of the video and the network and the institutions that support it and frame it are that much more important, because if you have a particular institution saying this is a video of something that happened, that will become much more important than the content of the video, if videos can be invented in that way. So that's a kind of prologue, that's like a prelude, which is, this is the situation that we're in relation to video. As embodied practitioners, that may have some meaning in relation to what we usually think of as performance documentation. This talk is kind of against performance documentation or alternatives to thinking about performance documentation, because clearly in this context there's not really any independent meaning of performance documentation. Certainly the transparency of the...
That's okay.
The transparency of the video, if it existed in the past, that we could kind of trust the video as a kind of raw data, is no longer with us.
That's okay, I don't need it anymore. Thank you.
So the audiovisual body. So what can we then do with the audiovisual body? Maybe like with strawberry puke, it's more about how we frame our bodies as they go into the audiovisual world. Because along with this goes the fact that we increasingly don't have control over our audiovisual bodies, that we increasingly have cameras everywhere in cities and surveillance everywhere. And so our audiovisual bodies also circulate without our knowing and without our awareness. And you can paint a whole kind of terrifying picture of that, but I don't really want to go in that direction. I kind of want to think about other ways of working with the audiovisual body, other ways of thinking about it, other ways of analyzing it, and maybe other ways of enacting it. So there's a lot of places I think we could turn to look at that. Music videos, history of video art, screen dance, visual anthropology, and kind of new emerging forms, ways of working with video. I mean, these are all fields that I've been looking at over the last year or so, 2 years, to think about, well, what if we wanted to frame the bodies that are appearing in the screen in other ways? What if the people whose bodies are being documented and being transmitted, how can we write on our own audiovisual bodies? How can we cause our own audiovisual bodies to circulate in ways that are more respectful or more authentic to our actual lived bodies? I'm not going to go into anything like a survey of these fields. I've kind of drawn on them in various ways in what follows. But as I said, I actually want to talk more practically. And my work is more about trying to design a different kind of embodied research laboratory. So I'm drawing on these different fields without being an expert in them, more in a practical or artistic sense, like what can we learn from the history of video art? What can we learn from visual anthropology or video ethnography about ethics and politics of the audiovisual body? But actually, the place that I mostly work, which I think probably resonates with you and with this week, is this enclosed space of the studio, or the empty room, or the emptied room, the room in which everything has been taken out, which is not most rooms. Most rooms have tables and chairs and various things like this, but if you take a room and you take everything out, you make a certain kind of room, which then some people are really interested in that kind of room. A lot of people are not. It's like, oh, an empty room. But some people are like, ah, an empty room. That's actually what I need. And that's a little bit too strict. I mean, obviously we don't all only work in empty rooms. I also don't only work in an enclosed studio. But this idea of enclosure is really interesting to me, and the idea of the laboratory, which comes in my work from Jerzy Grotowski, who got it from Konstantin Stanislavski. I won't go into that history. But I want to talk about how to make an embodied audiovisual laboratory. There's a little star there, because why is it called an embodied audiovisual laboratory? What does embodied actually mean here? Why not just an audiovisual laboratory? But I think there's something important there, because if I say an audiovisual laboratory, I mean, it is an audiovisual laboratory, what I'm talking about, but if I just say that, it's very easy to picture a scientific or cinematic space that's structured by the rules of those disciplines in which we put bodies. For example, there are these complex spaces that think of themselves as, I mean, that are laboratories, where you can have motion capture devices, or where you can have cameras on all of the walls with like 24 cameras, so you can, then you put dancers inside and you can kind of get like what they are doing on another level. We won't only see it or record it with video, but we're going to get it in 3D, or we can put things on the bodies themselves so we can map their dots in space, or we could put sensors on them so we can measure their skin conductivity, or track their eyes. We could put MRI scanners on them so we can figure out what their brains are doing while they're dancing. And I don't mean to dismiss any of that, but the topology of that kind of research is very much that you have a kind of scientific space, or at least a technologically oriented space, and then you put bodies in. And I'm interested in the reverse topology, so I am interested in the technology, obviously. I mean, the audiovisual body is generated through technology. But I'd like to reverse the topology. So what I'm really assuming is that as choreographers and performers, you already have an embodied laboratory, because you work in some kind of space where some research is done, some experiments are done with bodies, through bodies, as bodies. And I'm really talking about how to extend that audiovisually. So that's why I don't really, it's a bit clumsy, this phrase, embodied audiovisual laboratory, but I kind of landed on it as a way to say this isn't an audiovisual laboratory that bodies go in, this is an embodied laboratory that has an audiovisual dimension. So to make this kind of practical, and of course these are just suggestions, and actually this is the first time that I'm articulating these suggestions as like enumerated steps. So the naming of them is quite provisional. I welcome feedback and comments, and probably it will change. But thinking about some of this research I've done in the last couple of years on designing embodied audiovisual laboratory, I came up with three steps that I thought maybe could be useful provocations as you're going into your own practice. One, somaticize the camera, and I'll talk about each of these. Two is decenter the work, with a capital W. And three is frame yourselves. So, somaticize the camera. They'll all come back. Now I'm going to talk about each of them. Somaticize the camera. There's different ways we could think about this. There's a ethnographer named Claire Lussard, who's doing some lovely work, who's also a dancer, and she's been recently, I saw something that she wrote, which was a kind of really somatic body work with the camera. So it was really like hold the camera, feel its weight, kind of like move it physically on your body. We did some of that in the sense that when we were working with the camera, and I'm referring to a kind of specific 6-month laboratory project that I did in 2017, I'm not going to go into like the details of it, but basically there was a laboratory that I'm referring to. We did some of that kind of somatics of the camera, although we didn't focus really on the somatics in that sense of the embodied relationship of the individual holding the camera. That was kind of an indirect byproduct of what we were looking at, which was somaticize the camera in the sense of the topology that I just mentioned. So bring the camera into the space of embodied practice. Which is not an uncommon idea, I think, but increasingly it's a departure, because it's not performance documentation that you get out of that, because performance documentation is always predicated on the idea that there is something happening and then the camera arrives from outside and the camera is always external, and then you have reams of articles talking about how the camera always necessarily fails to capture whatever is happening. But that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense that if you construct the whole event as there being live work, which the camera will then try to capture, then obviously it's not going to capture that. On the other hand, if you think about the design of the space of practice as distinct from that idea of a work, that's the next number 2, getting ahead. If you think of the embodied research space as a kind of laboratory, and you bring the camera into that space, then the camera has to follow the rules of that space. So it's not that you are putting bodies into a space that has the rules, the technique, the infrastructure of, let's say, scientific measurement, quantitative measurement, or even cinematic creation, cinematic tracing, or even documentary filmmaking, but rather your space, our space. I say that in the sense of this being a choreographer's week, so a space of choreography, a space of experimental practice, of experimental theater or contemporary performance, and you bring the camera into that space, it has to follow those rules. So what are those rules? I'll tell you how we were working on it, and this may resonate more or less with what you've been doing, but I've started to think about the spaces that I work in terms of 4 relationships. This is quite formal, and in a moment I'll show you it gets really formal. I'm really enjoying this kind of formalization. It's a really different form. I mean, it's actually a notation system. So it's a kind of formalization almost like a lava notation or like musical notation in that sense. But it's really different than those, because it's notating something completely different. And I'm finding the formalization really interesting. So to formalize these 4 relationships, there's a relationship between a practitioner and some memorized material, so some forms. So you could think of it as a combination or a choreography, set of tasks, sequence of actions, line of actions, rules, some kind of memorized forms that govern what the person... Well, no. Actually, thinking of it as a relation is exactly not that it governs what the person does, but that they are in relation to it. Actually, I've been thinking about it mostly in terms of custodianship. We were working primarily with songs, but if you could think of it also as choreographies or dances, that this person has a relationship of custodianship to that material, meaning in this period of work, whether it's 30 minutes or 1 hour or 5 hours, you are working with that song. Doesn't mean you have to always be singing that song, doesn't mean you have to sing it fully, whatever that means. You are the custodian of that song, so you have a responsibility to bring that material into the space. Then, of course, there's a relationship of practitioners within a space of practice. And that's distinct from the first one, because those 2 practitioners could have some very tightly memorized material through which they have to relate. Like if you think about the difference between doing a tango, 2 people doing a tango, and 2 people doing contact improvisation, they're both having a very, very close relationship inside of this space of shared practice, but one has a much more complex and formalized, let's say, more structured, in some ways, set of materials that they're relating through. Then there's the external or directorial relationship. I find that as I'm talking about this in various contexts, this one kind of reveals my post-Grotowskian lineage in the sense that I see this directorial relationship as really valuable and really exciting in terms of what it makes possible in the space. That's a very specific way of thinking about directing, because it really doesn't have to do with a kind of overall control of the project, and it is really, in some ways, the opposite of the kinds of directorial dynamics that I think are so conducive to abuse in a lot of situations. This is the person who is able to offer some indications or some, maybe even some instructions, some comments from outside that space of practice, but it doesn't mean that they're in charge of the project. It doesn't mean that they hold a higher status. There's a whole list of things. It doesn't mean that we might associate with the word director or the word choreographer or composer or conductor. But it means, it actually is a spatial thing again, or a spatial metaphor again, in the sense that that person is initially outside the space of practice. Actually, they don't have to be outside the space of practice, because the director, of course, can be inside the space of practice as a practitioner if they're empowered to step outside in that moment where, if you're leading a workshop, for example, you might be very much participating in what's happening, but you step outside to give instructions. And this act of stepping outside, everyone can tell that that's happening, because if they didn't, you'd have this weird game of Simon Says, right, where the director steps outside to say something, but everyone says the same thing that as them instead of following the instruction if they didn't realize that they were stepping outside. So it's very clear, this act of stepping outside has to be clear for the space to work. And it's into this space that we could think of the videographic relation, or that I've been thinking of the videographic relation as appearing. So then it becomes part of this kind of ecology of relations. Because all of the associations that I just mentioned with the directorial role also tend to happen with the videographic role. And in the really, really hierarchical situations like Hollywood movies, the videographic relation and the directorial relation are kind of held together, and they go with the producing relationship, which is the financial power, and everything is kind of locked together in the hierarchy. But in disentangling them and disarticulating them, of course, the videographic relationship has a certain power. This is the person holding the camera, and they are deciding in each moment what the camera is focusing on, what it's recording, what it's not recording. But that power is a disarticulated power, a disaggregated power, alongside the other powers, like the directorial power to give comments or instructions in the moment. That's also a huge power. And then we can see also that the relationship of practitioners to each other and the relationship of the practitioner to the material are also huge powers. And so what we have is kind of a circulation of powers, or different, an assignment of powers, which can then circulate, of course, because these are roles, or relationships, so they don't, in the kind of laboratory that most interests me, they don't accrue to one body. So this is part of what's interesting about the notation. I'm not going to go too far into the notation, because I want to get on to some other stuff. But if you use, you can see here, these are initials of people, so Ben, Edda, and Agnieszka. So the people are kind of put as variables, but of course they don't behave like numbers, because they're people. But I've borrowed from algebra, or appropriated from algebra, these symbols, which allow us to formalize these relationships in a really interesting way, and you can actually write them out as algebraic formulas, which at first might seem really kind of weird and awkward and too formal. But what's really nice about it is that it allows you to structure these laboratory spaces in quite a complex way. And talk about things like, well, what if you're in the space and you are working on a particular song, but you're also the director, and someone else is in the space with you, and they're not working on any particular material, they're just kind of with you. But you can also do the same thing where the person who's not working on material is in the position of director. Either of those persons could hold the camera, or someone else could hold the camera. The person holding the camera could, as in the bottom example, be also in the director role, but they don't have to be. I mean, the specific notation is not, it's a little bit complicated. It's really interesting to work with, but the main point is to think about the circulations of relationships and powers, and to include the videographic power in that world. That might mean very different things according to how you structure your own practice. You'd have to think, you know, what are the rules of your own practice and how do you get the camera inside those rules so it doesn't become that your practice is over here and the camera is outside trying to get it, but your practice is the space and the camera is somehow inside it. What happens when you do that, as I alluded to before, is that the work, with a capital W, is radically decentered, because when I say work, I mean the dance work, the theater piece, the thing that you make that has to be to a certain degree repeatable, because you're going to show it to other people who are not part of the process at a certain time and place. And that structure, theatrical structure, brings with it so many things, because you know that these people are coming only for a half hour, only for an hour on this particular day. So although we may say, well, it's an experiment, there is an unavoidable pressure on that moment to be representative of the process, which it can never be. If you bring the camera into the space in this way that I've suggested, then the camera starts to generate audiovisual material which is transversal in relation to that performance product, because the camera starts to generate audiovisual material as soon as you turn it on, and it can do that all the way across weeks or months or years of practice. And it just goes along doing this transversally, generating tons and tons of material, and it doesn't care actually when the performance is. So it doesn't behave differently on the night before the performance than it does on the first day. And sometimes on the first day of rehearsal, really interesting things happen, because people are meeting who don't know each other, and there can be really significant misunderstandings and kind of strange cultural conflicts that are happening that are really interesting, which in the process will be smoothed away probably, or potentially incorporated in the work, but in a totally reconfigured way, because they have to be made repeatable. And the camera doesn't care about this kind of embodied repeatability, this kind of performance score on which the history of theater and dance as performance forms are constructed. It's totally transversal to that. Meaning it's totally like perpendicular, like you can go and make this performance and the camera just keeps going, and the day after the performance also, when you go back in the studio and you start again, it's still there, recording in the same way. What we did in this laboratory that I'm referring to, which lasted for 6 months, was we made a kind of catalog, which is online. You can go see it if you want. It has almost 200 clips, and it should have a bit more. We haven't done the last part. Should have about 250 probably, and it could also expand. But the idea is that these are very short clips. If you can see, underneath each title has the date that was recorded and the duration. You can see they're just 1 minute, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. There's a few in there that are like 8 minutes, but they're short clips. And this is across several months of research, with the camera recording probably 500 hours or 600 hours of material overall. So obviously with that amount of material, you don't want to go back and have to look through all of it and choose the clips. So again, you have a transversal relationship to what you're doing, where each day or each week you're looking at the audiovisual material that was created, and you're saying which moments are interesting, which is a really different way of thinking about what's happening in that empty space. It's related to saying which moments were interesting from the perspective of creating a repeatable score. We also say that, you know, which moments were interesting from the perspective of, can we do them again? But it's different than that, because in this case, the question isn't, can we do them again, but what should we call it, which is a really interesting question, and goes back to this kind of Instagram example, where the collage of image or audiovisual material and text is so important. And so often we don't choose, particularly as performers, we don't choose what that title is. So we don't choose the title of the work, or in a commercial setting, we don't choose the title of the work, we don't choose certainly the product that we're advertising or whatever it is. So what happens if the people who are in that space look at this audiovisual material, which again was not created by an external videographer, but by themselves through a circulating role of videographer? You can look at this kind of transversal development of practice. And of course there's aspects that grow, there's new things that are introduced, there's there's problems. There can be moments that are quite difficult, which you might not be able to put on stage, but which you can actually look at in the audiovisual material and find some very interesting things in. And the question of how to name it opens up a lot of complex questions about... So when we were doing this and creating this catalog, we were dividing up the material and we were saying, let's keep the editing as simple as possible. Choose an endpoint, an outpoint, and a title. That's it. And that has the advantage also of you don't have to get into complex video editing. But it's an extremely powerful role. This is another kind of power, another role, the editorial role, to choose the endpoint and the outpoint and the title of a moment that happened. Because that title might be technical, you know, like working on breath in a certain way, working on balance, or it might be more poetic, it might be more provocative. And what you're really asking there is which moments are interesting, which moments are worth sharing. And of course, it's not just about the live moment. Of course, it does have to do with the choices made by the videographer. So it's an audiovisual moment. It's not a live moment that you're sharing. But it's an audiovisual moment that came out of an embodied practice and which could not be generated otherwise. And it has a certain quality of being co-authored as well, because the videographer is one of the authors, but clearly not the only author, and the performing bodies, the practicing bodies, are also authors, and the question of authorship, like who made each of these moments, becomes really explicit. So the last suggestion, frame yourselves. This has to do with the issues that come up with making this kind of material. I said yourselves for that very reason that I just mentioned about co-authorship. One of the things about video is that it's really not possible to make video of yourself except by putting the camera on a tripod. Maybe in the future it will be more possible with video cameras that fly around or like auto drones, I suppose. I haven't really thought about that. But regardless, in the way that I've been approaching it, if video is one of these roles that circulates alongside directing and choreography or relationships to material or relationships to each other in a kind of improvisation, then it's generated by the combination, the specific, precise combination of those roles in a particular moment with those particular bodies. Because, of course, the whole point of those formulas that I showed you, the quasi-algebraic formulas, is that they're absolutely not at all like algebraic formulas, because if you put other bodies into those formulas, it would be completely different. And even if you put the same bodies into the same formulas on the next day, it'll also be completely different. So there's no sense in which the formula tells you what's going to happen at all. What it does do is kind of offer a bit of formal structure at a different level than other kinds of notation, because it doesn't say anything about what forms you're working with. Like in that notation for us, like it doesn't say anything about which songs we were working with. I haven't even mentioned which songs we were working with or why or who was in the room. But it structures something through notation at this level of powers or roles. So then you come out of there and you have all of this audiovisual material, and it's a really interesting question what to do with it. And that catalog that I just showed you is kind of what I think of as far as I've been able to figure out, it's the simplest possible thing you can do. And when I say simple, you can do that and have consensus on it because it's so simple. So like when we were doing that, when we were coming up with the clips, one person would take a bunch of video and look at it and choose some moments and say, you know, I'd like to choose these three moments and I'd like to give them these titles. But it was small, it's manageable enough that everyone can talk about that and have a big conversation and disagree over the titles and say, I don't like that title, let's do a different title. And you can arrive to consensus on that. In fact, that's why we haven't done Song Work 4, which is the part I mentioned that there should be more clips, because all the material we did in the last 2 months of the project has never been edited, because I do not want to go and edit it myself. It can only be added to the catalog legitimately if all three of us can go through the footage and choose things and then have a whole conversation and have consensus on it, and that requires other logistics. But so that's a format, this catalog, with these very simple choices of endpoint, outpoint, title, and perhaps comment, where there can be consensus. But of course, the audiovisual material can be really interesting. And there is a lot more you can do with it. So the other thing kind of that I've been developing, which is more complex, and I think for some people who are performance practitioners, may be kind of really not interesting because it goes into another form. It's another form of work, which is the video essay. With these, you can get unlimitedly complex, of course, because there's the whole history of filmmaking to contend with, and you know, I don't pretend to be any kind of expert on those, but what I do think is that from the position of having been one of the people in that space of practice, you have a privileged relationship to that audiovisual material, which is different from an editor or even someone who's just in the director role, or even someone who's in a director in practice role, like Clint Eastwood, but they are only in that role and it doesn't circulate. So there's a possibility to make some really interesting videos where the collage or the relationship between the audiovisual material and the textuality gets much more sophisticated and nuanced. Now, these video essays were primarily developed, I mean, this is an academically constituted lab, it's an academically funded lab. So the first intention of these video essays is to be peer-reviewed academic journal articles. Because strategically, but also, I mean, also seriously, like epistemologically, that's what establishes academic rigor. You can submit this kind of video essay to a peer review process and get peer review from people who don't know you and people who live hundreds or thousands of miles away, and you can also have someone come later and also and look at it again in a way that isn't possible with live performance. So these documents are, they can behave like academic articles in a particular way, and because of that, I think they have the potential to quite radically restructure some academic institutions. For example, the idea that one might do a PhD thesis that was in this kind of a format. I don't think it's ever been done, I think it has been done, but it's only started to be done, and for example, in the entire United States, at least in the theater world, I can say that's not possible at the moment. That would be quite controversial and impossible. It must be a written text. So that debate over what can be the form of a PhD thesis and how is it assessed is very important because that the PhD thesis is the gatekeeping into academic institutionality and academic research funding. So the question of what a peer-reviewed journal article can look like is also really important. But I don't think that's the only thing. I want to say, you know, if you're here and you have no interest in academia, I might interest you in academia, but if I don't succeed in that, I think these video essays have potential also in other contexts. I'm going to be spending the next year, starting about now, working with theater and dance companies and trying to see, can this work be interesting to people who are not really caring at all about academia and don't really care about whether something can be peer-reviewed or whether something can be the form of a PhD thesis, but are just interested in sharing their work. And I think there's still, even in that context, there's some way in which, here's the slide that I took out, but I'd like to show you now. I can show it to you because I kept it in a different place here. I don't know if you know this book by Catherine Profeta. It's about her work with Ralph Lemon over many, many years. Fantastic book. It's a book that resonates most deeply to me of any that I've read recently in terms of embodied research, and it's about dance. But this sense that she articulates in the book that, well, to put it in a nutshell, I mean, I gave you a huge quote to read, but to put it in a nutshell, the most interesting stuff often does not make it into the proscenium-oriented performance. So, taking that as a starting point, it could be interesting to think, even as a thought experiment, of what you do in the studio from the perspective of audiovisuality and the audiovisual body. Because, as I said, that really decenters the work. It doesn't decenter the audience, right? Because actually, these kinds of videos can have a much larger audience than any dance work can ever have. But it changes the audience radically. They're no longer a live audience who come to a specific time and place, but they're they become the mediated audience, which in some way, brings in all of these other possibilities of distance. But going back to what I started with, maybe we have a possibility to create and help develop a different kind of audience where the fact that it's videographic relation doesn't only mean that they are totally distanced or that they don't understand the depths of the practice. I mean, maybe we actually have to figure out how to use the audiovisual recording to more clearly articulate certain aspects of what happens in that empty room, in that space between bodies, also if they're outdoors or wherever, and the things that don't get into the live performance. The moments that don't get into the live performance. Maybe we can actually make a really important contribution to this audiovisual world, to the circulation of audiovisual bodies, if we take on this challenge of setting aside the question of performance documentation and accepting that, of course, if we're making a live performance, then recording will never capture it, and instead thinking, how do we make a short circuit between the stuff that happens in the room that's really interesting to us and the audiovisual world? And we leave aside the idea of a work or a performance for the moment. We can always come back to it. But we leave that aside for a moment and we say, there's stuff happening in the room that really interests us. And one way to show it to people is to build it into a repeatable score and then invite people to see that score. But there's a whole other way that's become available because it's possible to whip out a camera and not only take it out on a given day, but to have it there every day. In fact, probably most of you in the studio do have cameras, although in many cases they're left to the side in bags and turned off. But if they come out, it's a joke, but we do that because they're extremely powerful, and for all the reasons that I said in the beginning, because they can come out and capture something and then circulate without permission, and if it hasn't been discussed, can be outside the ethics that you've already established as people working together. Suddenly it's on Facebook, and suddenly you have comments like the one we started with. So there's every reason to keep them out until you're ready to bring them in. I'll mention one other thing, which is a journal that I also launched because I launched this before I started making those kind of video essays, but just when I was starting to think, like, wait a minute, we need to make video, and particularly, as I said, in academia, we need to make video that stands up as a research document, where it's not that you write an article and then you have some links to video, or you write your PhD thesis and in the back on the appendix or in the CD or on the website there's video. No, the video, again, it's topological, but this is not a different topology. It exactly reflects the topology I referred to before. This is not a textual article in which video is embedded. It's a video file in which textuality is embedded. And that simple, I mean, it's a media thing. It's a Marshall McLuhan, like it's just a change to the technology thing, but it has huge implications for who is understood to have knowledge, who is understood to conduct research, and how potentially how academic institutions are structured. So this is a video journal that publishes video articles in which each video article is a file, and people do contact me and say, like, can I send you a video article and also 2,000 words of text or 6,000 words of text, which will be sitting alongside it, and I really enjoy saying no to that. It's not a mean thing. I just know that there are hundreds of journals where you can publish your text, and in this one you have to put it all inside the video. So you can have as much text as you want, scrolling on the screen or appearing in different places. There's a lot of different things you can do. But it's a video article, fundamentally. Here are some approaches. There's actually 4 articles published now, and there's a couple more coming out, and there's more in the pipeline, and you're welcome to submit. But just looking at these, you can see there's some contemporary choreography on the top. In that video, there's no visual of dancing at all, even though it's about choreography. You just have João Figueiredo, Portuguese choreographer, with his drawings of the metastructure of the choreography, and how the dancer, this is about the metastructure of improvisation, like how does what happens happen, since there's no set choreography. It happens by something emerging, and then a dancer responds, and there's structures of time, etc. Below that, you have something coming out of intercultural performance training, where you have much more, like, there's the audiovisual body, you see the virtuosity, the athleticism, etc. On the bottom, something coming out of an exploration of medieval martial arts, where, if we start at the beginning, you have this kind of, very much this scientific lab, where he reconstructed a medieval suit of armor so that he could explore the embodied technique of medieval martial arts, because you can't really do that if you're not wearing what they would have worn. But there he is in a scientific studio getting precisely movement tracking and various kind of athletic quantitative tests, like it turns out that there's a particular extension of the arm which is actually has greater flexibility inside the suit of armor than it does outside the suit of armor, which is counterintuitive. So you demonstrate that that suit of armor doesn't only restrict, but actually enables the body in various ways. So those are two examples, because the first one was the set of research. I should have just mentioned one other thing important on this slide, is that I'm the editor of the top two, but Edda is the editor of the bottom two. And this is also just to say that, of course, the audiovisual material that's coming out of the studio is richly co-authored in a very complex way, and then when you get to the editing stage, there's a whole other series of questions about who's the lead editor. And there's a kind of a spectrum between collaborative editing, which is what happened with the catalog, where we kind of talked about everything through to consensus, versus an editing based on consent, let's say consent, where Edda might make an edit of this video and send it to me, and I might say, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way, but that's fine. You know, it doesn't bother me. You can publish that so that there's more flexibility, so you can have more individually authored works. And that comes up, of course, also in the videos here. Question of, like, who is the author of these videos? Which bodies that appear also have an important authorship role, and which are more in a traditional role of performance. So, concluding, frame yourselves, meaning this kind of, which goes back to this Instagram as well, in that context of this audio, this massive audio visuality, what are the ways, from simple to complex, that you can not only kind of reclaim the circulations of your audiovisual body that are already happening, but actually reinvent the circulation of the audiovisual body from the very specific practice that you come from and that you believe in. Thank you. Comments. If you don't mind, I'll record them because I find it really interesting and useful. And maybe would even put them online.
I'd like to start. It's interesting for me. I'm completely non-technological person. I mean, I can't handle technology. I always kept it as far away from myself. But having worked with like very different generations of artists, choreographers in the studio, in very different contexts, it seems that, and this is already going on since the 80s, that the camera has it's always been part at some point of their creative process like that. And that also most of them use the camera in a very conscious way. I give two extreme examples. I know one choreographer, older generation, he works, his whole rehearsal process is embodied research. And he works with the same group of dancers because he has an established company. He does this for weeks in a row. And then when he sends the group is ready, they do one or two groups of improvisations, which he films. It's like an hour thing. And then he becomes the editor. He goes in, and there's only two times that he used the camera, maximum in this process. And then he edits the whole piece on the basis of these two improvisations, and then the last part of the process is just the dancers learning what he edited like that. The other extreme is this kind of thing where the camera is constantly on and passed on from one dancer to the other, which I recently had. But then still it's the choreographer who then looks at this amount of work and decides which material is going to be further developed and in which way it is. So it seems that the tension is that the camera allows for a much more massive transversal, as you call it, storing of material, but then the actual creating is always this choice making of which material do you keep in the editing and how do you then so and it's also how the younger generation of choreographers now uses the internet as their main library, because it's all there, so instead of kind of finding your own body, it's already out there, so just find the movement that inspires you, learn it, and in the learning process it's already transforming, so and you bring it somewhere else like that. But so the question I have is this: the camera just seems to open up because of the more material available, but then if you go to the moment of authorship or really creating, which is the choice making, which then happens in the editing, you go back to a very traditional form of authorship. Always feels like it.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's really perceptive and interesting question. It makes me kind of think and realize that when I started to organize this lab project, the main intention was to think about other ways of working with video. That was the explicit intention. And I think also continuing, people are excited about video, there's new possibilities with video, you can get funding to work with video, etc. But actually it turned out that it was the work on power relationships and circulating roles and dynamics that was fundamental to it. Like when we met, the three of us, on the first day, I said, okay, we're going to go into the studio. For the first 2 weeks, we'll go into the studio and we'll have a practitioner, a director, and a videographer, three roles. We'll do an hour and a half in one configuration, half-hour break, rotate, hour and a half, half-hour break, rotate. So each person is in each role each day for an hour and a half. That's a six-hour day. We'll do that for 2 weeks, and then we'll see what happens. And somehow I wasn't even thinking of the roles and the circulation as being that important. It was just a kind of question of like, what can we do in this space? But actually that's the essential work, and that is much older in my own practice. That goes back much long before I was thinking about video in this way. It's about the power dynamics and the disarticulation of the power dynamics. I think that, the video allows for something which is quite difficult to get in practice. Because one of the kind of justifications for the accrual of hierarchy in performance production processes and the stickiness of the directorial power that can stick to someone's body, that's probably from Sarah Ahmed that I'm saying sticky, is that there's a kind of justification which is like, well, we have to make something. And although you can experiment with, each person gets to direct 20 minutes out of the final work, there's always a kind of zero-sum thing where the time spent on one thing is not spent on another, and then the coherency of the overall... think about artistic coherency. What you get when you circulate the roles is a multiplicity, a kind of chaos. It's not that that hasn't been tried, but in the kind of a theatrical situation where there's that kind of pressure on the event, it's quite difficult to sustain that kind of distribution of the roles because you actually don't know what will happen. Like, it's a really open experiment. When you're working with transversal video, there is this possibility, which is what I tried to show with the video essays page, where
The two video essays that are edited by me are, like, I'm able to do this editorial role and take the moments that I want. I can even put text on them and edit them, so I assume that role of director. But someone else from the team can take the same session and edit it in a different way, or name it in a different way. So there's a kind of very specific technical possibility of distributing the editorial power, which is pretty exciting to me. I mean, you can distribute the editorial power amongst team members, and also, as I mentioned, across the time of the process. Like, you can say, well, actually, I think this thing which happened on the first day was really, really interesting, even though it obviously wasn't the result of a lot of rehearsal, like, it was just when we met, but that's a really interesting moment. You can take that. And so there are some possibilities for circulating power that are specific to the technology. But that's, you know, that's secondary. That's also to say, like, it's the circulation of power that's kind of the underlying ethics. And the idea of somaticizing the camera here is about putting all of those kinds of technological powers inside the ethics that I think of in association with embodied research, which is not necessarily the same as performance production, although, I mean, either one can be obviously hierarchically organized or organized in different ways.
I think I understand how uniquely you use the video piece of the puzzle, but I'm hoping you could share a little bit more about how you use the audio piece of the puzzle, whether that's taking cues from the notes during rehearsals or just following the breath that you capture during rehearsals. Where does the audio part really
come? Yeah, this is probably something I skipped because of not being a choreographer and not being based in a dance context. So I'm working in a theater department, although my work is coming from a very experimental, physical, song-based theater, so I've often found a home in dance contexts, and I always feel kind of out of place in either dance or theater or music, pretty much. But this whole lab was based on songs. So, it doesn't come across at all here because I've muted it. Let me see. Oh, you know what I'll just do? Just show you a moment. This has to be very brief, but if I have the sound, oops, no, I don't have the sound, do I? Okay. We were fundamentally working on songs, and we were working on a set of very culturally, linguistically, and functionally diverse songs that had, and geographically diverse songs that had all been labeled as Jewish by the Smithsonian Institution as part of a project that was to research identity as well as technique. So the kind of main material that we were working with that was organizing the project was these songs. So in that sense, the audiovisual is like, for me, the audiovisual body is something that captures certain aspects of my lived body that are not captured by text. I mean, what happened for me, particularly in this video, which is one of the most important ones. So this is a video of me, which I've put these texts on top of. And so in this video, my kind of scholar, textual, critical, whatever self, and my singing, moving self are both present. And that's something that I had not been able to find. You know, I was in academia, I was writing, and the thing that was perceptible about me was that I was writing. In theater, the thing that was perceptible about me was that I was singing and moving or whatever. And even if I could bring something from my academic work, but it wasn't perceptible at any level of depth, and likewise in academia. So in this medium, they were coming together. So for me, it has to be audiovisual body because so much of my work is based on song. I think if your work is very much in the world of movement and is more present in a visual way, then it might not be as significant. But, you know, it's about how the body is perceived and how the body appears. So, what can can I say, there is a difference between the audiovisual body and the visual body and the audio body and the written body. And, you know, if we think of all these media as tracings of embodiment, then we're just getting different facets.
I'm intrigued by these video essays, and I can imagine in the academic context that students who do research, and certainly practical research, in relation to choreography, it could be very interesting to use this. My question is in relating to this context. We are not in academia context, we are practice-based context. Could you also make transfers to us how these video essays could also be used in a more practice-based environment like this?
Yeah, I can try. I mean, I feel like I don't have a strong answer to that. I'm at the beginning of thinking about that. I've just reached out to a bunch of theater and dance companies and had some interest in terms of, like, would you like to do video labs with me and see what we can come up with? I mean, what I do think is true that I've heard from people now, and I certainly experienced myself, is that there are kind of two main modes that people think about video in terms of sharing their work. And this is different than video integrated in the performance process or on screen in the theater itself, but in terms of, like, what you publish on the internet, you know, what we add to this big audiovisual world. There's performance documentation, which is at least in theater, it may be much more sophisticated in some areas that I don't know, but in a lot of places it's still like a tripod in the corner trying to get everything that happens in the room, which is just so, as we know, impossible to watch or to get what you want from it. And then there's marketing videos, which are often handheld and exciting and they go around and everything, but they're edited fast like movie trailers, and the purpose is to get people interested and curious, but it's not to expose. The title of the new project that I'm starting now is called Windows into Worlds. And so the idea is, wouldn't it be nice to be able to have an audiovisual presence online that feels more adequate to what you do? Because marketing materials are marketing materials, and static performance documentation are just, you know, those are necessary for grant applications often. But in terms of how we appear on the internet with the kind of work that we do, how shall we appear? I think that is increasingly of interest because the internet is there, and it's not just for marketing, because, I mean, people are seeing it who are millions of miles away, who can't afford and can't get visas to come see your work. So, you know, it's not just for marketing, and it's not just for grant applications. It's like a space. It's a parallel space. There's documentaries that people make, but they usually, very often, they follow a regular documentary telling all, like, you know, start on day one and go towards the performance, and the performance happens, yay, and it's done. How would we like to appear in that world is the question, and I think that's an important question. Yeah, I think this level of textuality is only going to be interesting to people who are already quite academic and reading tons of books at the same time, and then thinking, like, well, how do you put the book stuff on top of the dance stuff? If you're not doing that, then you might, why would I want that stuff? But in terms of, yeah, and I, you know, I mentioned screen dance before because, like, there's a whole world of this which I'm only learning about now. Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing to add is sort of, like, is just, like, if you think of the space as a space of research without aiming towards either a live production or a movie in the sense of a movie like a music video or some kinds of work of screen dance. So the video isn't initially a product, it's a transversal cut. It's an epistemic cut across the process. And then you look at the video and say, how can I use this to more adequately appear in the audiovisual world? Perhaps there's, you know, my thinking is that we have something to add to the audiovisual world. In the sense of kind of the ethics of practice and the ethics of embodiment.
Thank you very much for this so far, Ben. I wanted to ask you if you could comment on the relationship between the video essay as a form of exposition, knowledge production, sharing of knowledge, but specifically in the power relation between the artist and the audience. because I feel we're stuck in the to make something, as you said, or we're directed at creating products or events. So how can we use video essays to share process and see the value in that on a social level?
Yeah, thank you. Again, this is just a question that I'm kind of trying to orient towards now, coming out of this lab process. But
so
one
you're sharing your process with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
In one of the so in this project that I'm starting, this idea of Windows into Worlds, one idea is about exhibition and gallery space. Because it has a different temporality. I'm interested in it. I mean, I've never done anything in that kind of space. But the idea would be in that kind of space, which is inherently durational, where it's just open for a long time, what if you put together some different elements that could include, so hopefully like a catalog, first of all, of videos that are put together in the exhibition, but which come from theater and dance companies, which are not only geographically diverse, but very diverse in genre and perhaps level of establishment. So you might have some new small theater ensembles that were just founded in Huddersfield, where I live, and then some more established names that are based in New York or wherever. But they've both submitted 5 clips of 3 minutes with a title and a comment. And maybe 20 or 30 of those companies, so that you have, again, the horizontality of the catalog format. And of course, that can be online, or it could be in a gallery format. That's just an experiment of form. But the horizontality of the catalog format as a place for these different clips to appear. And then beyond that, there's a sort of participatory relational possibility, which I don't know how to structure, but the idea would be that there's some kind of open lab space. So one question that's really concrete that comes out of this, which actually is already happening at the level of a quite well-funded long-term lab, but it certainly happens when you lead a workshop over, like, let's say you have 5 days. So like, let's say tomorrow you go into the studio and you bring in lots of cameras and you make a lot of footage. And let's say you agree that that audiovisual material that you make together is collectively co-authored by whoever was in the space at the time. So that's exponentially more difficult depending on the more people there are. So like if you do it in groups of 3, then you can potentially create an ethical relationship in that moment, and then that can be sustained outside the studio. If all 20 of you do it, it's much more complex also logistically to coordinate. So one thing that I've been asking technically, practically, is how to fold the editing process into a short session, which with the catalog, it's potential to be, I have tried, for example, 1 2-day weekend workshop, where on the first day, people were in trios, director, practitioner, videographer. They rotated the trios, so there was a rotation of roles. Out of that came this audiovisual material. And then people overnight were selecting these clips and titling them and getting kind of agreement or debate or consensus the following day with their trio. And then at the end, we have 15 or 20 clips, which I haven't yet put online because it's a little bit ambiguous, like, are they interesting? Because those people only work together for one moment, and then they kind of, but they could be interesting. I think it's a question of scale. Like, I think we have maybe we only have 10 or 12. It doesn't feel interesting yet, but if there were 100, that could be even more interesting, potentially. Because it takes away some of the pressure of, like, this moment is a performative moment, and it goes towards the horizontality of, like, so another possibility of a public kind of participation would be an open lab where people who are not performers would come and do some structured activity, like teach someone a song. So if one person teaches another person a song and the third person is a videographer and you rotate those roles, then in a couple of minutes, or in 10 or 15 minutes, you can get video that's somehow intimate or opening of the people. And then if in that same moment that video can immediately be transferred to a computer and then they want to watch it and then they want to choose clips and title them, you could make a kind of public catalog. How interesting it would be, I don't know.
Could you imagine the audience editing, making the editing choices like sort of a Wikipedia construct?
By audience, that was referring to non-performer people who would be walking by, let's say, a public exhibition space. So is that what you mean by the audience? Who's the audience?
I mean, if you were to have a catalog of video essays, could you imagine a construct such as Wikipedia, where the online audience,
oh,
if
I
there
see.
Is such a thing,
yeah,
would be the editor?
That's also an idea, is to have a kind of open space. I mean, I don't know about the complexities of open versus curated in terms of that kind of space online. But certainly there's possibilities for, like, YouTube channel or video channel. If it's theater and performance companies that are contributing clips, that's a really interesting community for me. So I'd be really interested to have, like, 100 clips from 100 different theater and dance companies. If it's kind of anyone who's on the internet, that could potentially be less interesting. Although, you never know. It depends how it's framed, you know, and what level of curation there is. I mean, you know, what do we think of YouTube in terms of as a space that anyone can upload to? Is it interesting? Is it not? It's too disorganized to know whether it's interesting. Perhaps we should finish then. I think we have another performance to attend. Thank you very much.
Thank you.